Let me all introduce Tracy Novak. She's with us tonight, and she is going to talk to us about open war meetings. We'll let her have the floor, and then if you have any questions for her after she's finished, you're welcome to ask. So Tracy, it's all yours.
Great. Can I share my screen, please?
Yeah.
Who is it that enables that?
It's Eric trying to do it, I believe.
Okay. Thanks, Eric. There we go. Great. So what we're going to do this evening is we're going to give you some of information with which I'm sure some of you are already familiar. Also, some of which might be new to you. This will focus particularly on the ethics of serving as a school committee member, the role that the school committee plays in terms of the school district, and then also looking particularly at the open meeting law, as that was what you had asked me particularly to focus on. And again, some of this will be review. Some of it may also be an emphasis that you perhaps haven't heard before in terms of your particular role on the school committee. So the first thing that I always make sure that I focus on when I speak with school committees about their position is the code of ethics that we hold in common across the state. This is part of the policy that just about every school district has. I believe it's BA, but it's a common statement of ethics that really dates back to the early stages of the organization. And notes that the responsibilities of the school committee, first of all, are clearly delineated in the Massachusetts general laws, but that every school committee member in Massachusetts also takes an oath to both the United States Constitution as well as the Massachusetts Commonwealth Constitution. And you thus are bound as a member of your local school committee to, in fact, both state and federal regulations. And as a regional district in particular, you actually are much more directly an agency of the state. We outline the responsibilities within this code of ethics in three areas. One is community responsibility, which I think we perhaps emphasize quite a bit when it comes to school committees. But the other two are the areas of responsibility to the school administration and the area of responsibility to your fellow school committee members. And for those who perhaps imagine things more in terms of visuals, one of the ways that's valuable is to think of yourself as part of this tripartite relationship, that your relationship is not only to your constituency, and most particularly in a regional district, it's important to remember that you don't only hold a responsibility to your town, you also hold a responsibility to your fellow members of your school committee, and you also hold a responsibility to the administration. Okay. So to take each of those in turn, in terms of your responsibilities to the community, which is the one that perhaps most often gets spoken of, particularly among elected officials, your primary responsibility is actually to the children. What I'll do is I'll review these, and then for each one, I have some conclusions that I want to make sure that I pull out particularly for you. We'll talk more about this in a moment, but of course, your primary function is not administrative. It is not overseeing the day-to-day operations of the district. That is actually why you have administrators. That is why you employ them. That is their job, not the school committee's, quite particularly, according to Massachusetts general law. You are part of a team. You are a member of a committee. And once the decisions are made by a committee, you have a responsibility to abide by those decisions and to, in fact, do what you can to carry out those decisions. That's part of the job that you have. You do have a responsibility to continue to be well-informed on both local, state and on also on national issues regarding education. There's certainly been plenty of information to be informed about this past year. You do need to remember that this is a hat that actually never comes off. You are always representing the community, regardless of the context in which you are. And you do need to always remember that this is a position that is a means of unselfish service without any playing politics, playing for your name to be making a splash or to make a particularly sharp point, let alone, of course, to benefit personally, which would be a violation of the state ethics laws. A couple of things that you should draw as conclusions from this. Your first responsibility is to the students. Sometimes we get questions asking, relatively speaking, where, for example, are the constituency that you voted for you or those sorts of things. You're a school committee member. Your largest constituency is one that actually cannot vote for you, which is that it is your student body. And that's crucial really to remember in your decision making. In a regional district, I always think it's important to remember that you actually represent all students, even the ones that don't live in your town. And once you serve on this committee, the students of the district, not the students of your town, are those that are your concern. And that's really very, very important in a regional district to remember. Any other responsibility in this role comes after that one. So when you are having to, for example, make decisions around staff, or you're having to make decisions around the constituencies in your town, it really needs to be your students that get held first with other constituencies or other considerations after that. Something that was pointed out to me once at a national conference, we talk about a governor, we talk about a congressperson, we talk about a selectman. There is actually no term for a member of a school committee beyond that of being a member of a school committee. You have no position, you have no authority, you have no power outside of you meeting in a properly posted meeting around issues that are actually under your purview. As an individual, you have no authority at all. And in fact, there is no even term for who you are beyond that you are a member of this committee. And again, you represent the district, you don't represent the town. And that really is an important, much in the way that I would have this conversation when I speak to my municipal committee members who may represent particular wards and so forth. Once you become a member of the committee, you don't represent that ward, you're representing all of the children of the district. And that is an important thing for all of you as you're working together to make good decisions for the schools. So in terms of your relationship with the school administration, your role in terms of policy, we're going to talk about the four roles that you have by Massachusetts General Law Chapter 71 in a section. But in terms of your role in policy, sometimes that seems a little esoteric and removed for people. It's important to remember that it's actually that creation of clear policy that you then, when you hand it off to the administration, allows them to be able to develop good protocols and good lines of doing work. That allows them to actually effectively do the day-to-day running of the district. Making sure that you recognize and support the administrative chain of command. This is one of the first ones that I think some school committee members run into, which is the complaint that comes in about somebody's particular teacher or particular something else, and ensuring that you as a school committee member direct that back to the appropriate location, rather than you're taking that to anyone else, most particularly the superintendent. Making sure that you give the chief administrator, the superintendent, full responsibility for discharging his or her responsibilities and then hold them responsible for the results. And making sure that you refer all complaints to the administrative staff for solution and only discuss them at meetings if such solutions fail. Which means that in general, the day-to-day running of the district is not actually going to be the business of the committee. The day-to-day running of the district is the business of the administration. Policy, goals, budget, eventually superintendent evaluation, that is actually the purview of the committee, not the day-to-day running of the district. So if we were in person, pop quizzes work a little bit better. I'm not going to actually have you do them this way, but really important to remember that as an individual member of the committee, you do not actually have any authority, only a quorum of the school committee meeting together. in a properly posted meeting has any authority, and then only authority on matters that are under the school committee's purview. So a couple of things that means, you can only act as a member of the committee. You cannot act in any other aspect from your position here, aside from that, as of any other voter co-equal with those in your community. You do need to ensure that you as a committee member work within whatever your agreed upon protocols are in communicating with the superintendent, with other administrators, and with other district staff. What that means is that each committee has a particular set of ways in which questions are asked, requests are forwarded, and so forth. If in your committee, that means that all requests run through the chair, that means that your requests need to run through the chair. If in your committee, that means that requests need to go through the superintendent, that means that requests need to go through the superintendent. And if this is not a conversation that you've had as a committee, I urge you to do so. It's particularly important, I would say, in districts that are small and have a limited number of administrators, and thus have administrators that are doing a lot of different kinds of functions. Their time is short, they have a lot going on, and making sure that there is a very clear, smooth protocol to ensure that they're not continually getting pulled in a lot of different directions is very, very important, because most of their day-to-day work should not actually be answering to the school committee. If as a member, you feel there is a need for particular information, particular report, particular gathering of something, the appropriate place for that communication to be coming is through a committee meeting on an agenda, and then for the committee to decide if that is something that is needed. If you're going to be as a committee requesting time to be spent on something, that needs to be the committee that's asking for that, not an individual member asking for that. So that's very, very important. You do not, as a member, have the right to demand reports be made for you as an individual member. You do want to make sure that you always stay within your purview of policy, budget, goals, and evaluation, that you aren't meddling in day-to-day operations. And again, you want to make sure that you're referring members of the public to the appropriate district contact. I would say that not infrequently committee members find that this is actually an important part of their role, that they tend to know who the right person is to call for things, that this is something where you really need to contact the teacher, or maybe you should get in touch with the nurse and so forth. That's actually a valuable place for you to be working. In terms of your other committee members, it's important to recognize that action that's taken at official meetings is binding, and also that you as an individual cannot bind the committee outside of meetings. You cannot say we as a committee are going to do X, Y, and Z. That's not something that you have the authority to do. Once the committee has taken an action, that is actually a binding action. And remember that you are actually a legal entity within the state system. Making statements or promises ahead of time about how you'll vote on matters that come before the committee is an inappropriate thing to do. You as a committee make decisions based on deliberation that takes place within the committee meetings. Thus, the idea that you're going to be coming to the table already having determined the action that you're going to take means that you're not actually allowing the public body to do its work. If you have executive sessions, you want to make sure that you uphold the intent. Remember, you are brought into executive session, and we'll talk more about this in a moment, for particular reasons, and they're always to protect the interest of the district. If you violate executive session, you are actually fracturing the responsibility that you have to the district. Likewise, if you receive privileged communication, make sure that you respect and uphold that. If there's information that you have that is relevant to your fellow members, you want to make sure that you share that in a way that doesn't violate the open meeting law. Frequently, those communications will go either through the superintendent or the superintendent's secretary. And then again, you want to make sure that you make decisions only after all facts or on a question have been presented. So what this means, first of all, is that even if you're in the minority position, you're still a member of the committee. And that means that you still need to make sure that you uphold decisions that the committee has made, even if you voted against it. You need to make sure that the business of the district is what you're focused on here in meetings. And this, by the way, is something that we've seen a lot of committees run into this past year. There's a lot of people who are under the impression that school committees meet in order to hear from the public. That's actually not why school committees meet. School committees meet in order to conduct the business of the district. There may be particular ways in which the committee chooses to hear from the public, or there may be particular ways in which the committee can be better informed by the public, but that's not actually the purpose of the public meeting. You are a public body who meets in public. That does not mean that the public is guaranteed time to comment. And you actually have particular business that you are required to conduct in order for the district to be able to move forward. You need to make sure that that happens. That means, by the way, that as you're having the meeting, you want to make sure that you as individual members are accountable yourself, and then also keep each other accountable to do things like stay on task and make sure you're not running off in different directions. Make sure that you're not spending time on things that you don't necessarily need to, and defer to the chair in running the meeting. That means that what the chair actually is the one who is managing the meeting. The chair is the one who is calling on people when they speak. People need to make sure that they're not speaking out of turn. People need to make sure that they stay orderly in terms of this. When committees make decisions, they make them as a result of deliberation. As you come across information, you want to make sure that you share it with your fellow members to strengthen the committee and thus the district as a whole. And you do want to make decisions, as I said before, only after all information is shared and after matters are deliberated. So I share those with you because that's actually really about what keeps you focused as a committee. There is some very good research out there around what makes for effective committees. And some of it, and the ethics I share in particular, because having effective self-governance in which you as committee members hold yourselves accountable for actually being an effective board is part of that if you want to actually have a successful district. You also want to make sure that you're staying focused on district goals, that you as committee members do participate in professional development, which by the way is part of what you're doing this evening, that you're monitoring progress of the district towards goals, and that you're always focused on student achievement. And by the way, student achievement is not just about MCAS scores, which we probably knew before, but particularly focused on this past year. Effective school committees have a district vision. They hold themselves accountable first before they hold each other accountable. And that means that really ultimately committees are self-monitoring and self-policing in terms of their behavior and ensuring that they actually focus on the job that they're there to do. A strong relationship among members and also with the superintendent is an important part of districts acting effectively. Focusing on data and collaborating. We will talk a bit more about trust and respect in a moment, but I do always make sure that I mention that respect is earned. It isn't necessarily simply granted. Trust is also earned, and that's something that you want to make sure you're doing over time. So in terms of the roles, I mentioned before that one of the things that's really crucial for committee members to understand is their position relative to what goes on in the district. There is, I think, particularly when people are running for office, sometimes for a temptation, at least, for committee members to potentially make kinds of promises of what they're going to see happens. And very, very often, these end up being very much in the realm of management. The day-to-day management of the district is not under the purview of the school committee. Overall governance is under the purview of the school committee. So I've put this in, this is put in several different ways. This is part of the district governance project, which was put together by my colleague, Dorothy Presser. But you can think of it in terms of the school committee being focused on mission and vision, whereas strategies and action plans are what the superintendent and the superintendent's team are working on. The school committee looks at goals and policy, whereas when that's broken down at the superintendent's level, that's actually regulations and procedures, which are obviously going to be much more specific. And then of course, ultimately the budget is actually an end that then gets implemented by the superintendent as a means. In general, this doesn't always work, but in general, if it's an answer to what, why, or how much, it's under the purview of the school committee. If it's an answer to how, who, when, or where, it's under the purview of the superintendent. Generally speaking, the committee should be acting as a bridge between the community and the superintendent, with the superintendent acting as a bridge between staff and committee. In both cases, those are somewhat inexact, but that is the intent. And at the bottom here, there's a bit of a back and forth as to how process tends to happen. Generally speaking, if you look on the right-hand side, the superintendent will recommend an action to the school committee, which then votes that action to implement. The implementation then takes place back on the superintendent's side, and the school committee then monitors that implementation. Ultimately, as I've mentioned before, this is about trust and respect, and that needs to be shared between the committee and the superintendent, which then allows for a strong foundation of community respect. I will say that community respect, again, is earned, and also in all cases here, trust, once it's lost, is actually very difficult to regain. So hopefully, if I asked you how many bosses the superintendent had, you'd be able to tell me right off the top of your head that there is only one. This is not a question which varies according to the number of school committee members in the district. The only overseeing authority of the superintendent is the full committee meeting in a properly posted meeting, not individual members of the committee. So that is actually very, very crucial for individual committee members to understand. Evaluation, of course, we'll talk about in a second, but evaluation happens as part of the committee process, again, in a properly posted meeting. So now the circles represent the committee and the individual member. Power is always exercised through official action at properly posted meetings. The governing of the district happens through policy, and also through the use of financial resources. You as a committee should engage with the community, but you also need to make sure that you're continuing to sustain the relationship you have with the superintendent, as well as among yourselves. And of course, you're the employer of record with your collective bargaining units. As an individual member, you do not have any individual authority and no greater power than any other qualified voter. You should be contributing and communicating to the district vision and goals. Those are two things that are under the purview of the committee. Asking critical questions is part of your job. Supporting committee decisions once they are made through deliberation, and being dedicated to the work on behalf of the student. So with that, I want to stop there and ask if there's any questions so far before we talk about the four roles of the school committee.
Anyone have any questions so far? Okay, Tracy.
All right. So the four roles of the school committee are actually spelled out very clearly to us in Massachusetts General Law, Chapter 71. And the first one is goal setting. Now, there's a number of reasons why we set goals as school committees. It is actually how you exercise leadership. But part of the reason you set goals is so that nobody else will. If you don't set goals, someone else will, and that will be the direction the district goes in. It is also how you continue to improve the school district by actually being very deliberate about it. And it also is a clear way of communicating to the community, as well as, of course, internal to the school district, where it is that the district is headed. We always think it's important for you to know, as members of the school committee, that your goals actually form the foundation of goal setting for the district. So the district level goals and then the goals that you set for the superintendent should then become that which underlies administrator goals in the district, ultimately teacher goals in the district, which of course then are leading to student achievement. So this is intended to be a process by which your work at this level really is what's leading to that very direct classroom work that's happening and the goals, again, that are set by all educators in the district as part of their educator evaluation process. Policy is also part of the delineation of the school committee's responsibilities. Traditionally, when I talked about policy, I'd have a lot of people potentially who were old school committee members sort of either roll their eyes or their eyes would get big because they'd be thinking about these giant binders. Still exist, I'm sure, somewhere in your district because we're required to keep paper copies of them. But most people now are more familiar with them as PDFs that exist online. They are intended to be effectively the mid-level between the Massachusetts and federal laws, plus anything that's specifically regulation that's laid out by the department, and the implementation of that at the district level, sometimes through regulation, sometimes through policy, sometimes through procedure. But it is effectively you are holding that middle ground, which then allows the superintendent to discharge their duties in a positive direction. I always think it's important to note that that is not, however, the giant policy manual is not the only place that policy can be found. If you have student handbooks, that is another policy document, but you're also setting policy when you agree to your collective bargaining agreements. When you are adopting your minutes, sometimes you can find policy in your grant applications. If you have legal documents that are filed for you by counsel, sometimes those are policy statements. Directives of the superintendent and past practice both can be. Your regional agreement itself has policy included in it, as does your town, as do your town charters. And we also emphasize to committees that when they adopt their budget, they're actually adopting the most important policy statement of all, because any of the language that you've adopted elsewhere is effectively meaningless unless you've actually backed it up with the spending that you do in your budget. So those are two things. I always think it's important for school committee members to think about their relationships as being interrelated. The adoption of the budget should be very focused on what your district goals are. Those are two things that should actually go hand in glove with each other. In terms of your role in personnel, obviously most of the personnel decisions are made by the superintendent. You do, however, hire and contract with the superintendent. You also are the ones who hire and retain legal counsel. Do you have advice and consent on several positions here? If you run into that, I always recommend that you actually look up the specific Mass General law that talks about it. That's something we can help you with through the office, because the language around each of those is slightly different. Excuse me. Also, of course, you are the employer record of your collective bargaining agreements. The superintendent is hired by the school committee and then is the chief executive officer and the manager of schools, generally has oversight over all personnel besides that, supervises the principal, and then initiates the budget proposal, manages the approved budget. And also, after you've adopted policy, the implementation of that policy is done by the superintendent. In terms of budget, there's actually sort of two pieces here. There's the general pieces of the budget, which, as some of you know, I could talk about at length and frequently do, but also your fiscal policies, which is section D of your policy handbook, goes into laying out some very specific lines around making sure that money is managed in particular ways, which then again gets handed off to your superintendent, your business manager, in terms of how that work is done on a day-to-day operational basis. You do have the responsibility down to the cost center level, but not beyond it. That is where your transfer should be coming from. And of course, you are the signers of warrants. We have tended, particularly this past year, to reflect a great deal on Burke, who may have had mixed opinions in other ways, but did make this great statement regarding what it is that you owe to your constituency, which is ultimately you owe them your judgment, not just to defer your opinion to theirs. So, as was mentioned earlier, one of the things that I'm here to talk to you about is the open meeting law. And the thing to remember about the open meeting law as a member of a public body is that this is designed to ensure that the members of the public know what their government is doing. That's what's supposed to be happening. It ensures transparency. Among other things, it means that they know ahead of time what kinds of things are going to be discussed, and that they're provided particular kinds of access to that decision-making process and to the decisions that are made once those decisions are made. So in general, notice of a meeting has to be posted with the agenda for all meetings. Meetings in general have to be open to the public unless you enter into executive session for a particular reason. And minutes have to be kept for both open and executive session. Now that's the 3-point summary. There's obviously much more than that. A meeting under the open meeting law, and I always think of this as the tripartite test, is a deliberation by a public body about something that's under that party's purview. So we're gonna go through a couple of things here that actually show up with other places a public body may actually be. You will note that in all of those cases, the public body is not deliberating about something that's under that body's purview. However, anytime that there is a quorum, or there is the beginnings of a quorum that is deliberating about something under the purview of that public body, that is when things need to end, because that is actually when you're heading towards a violation of the open meeting law. The open meeting law, by the way, first is policed by the body itself, and then secondarily is policed by the Attorney General's office. So this is the same three-part test that I gave you already. This does, of course, emphasize that communication among members does not have to be in person. It does not also have to be oral. It can be written and it can be electronic. And that's been something that I've been continuing to caution people about because of course, a lot of our communication right now is electronic. Certainly you wanna make sure that you keep your CC list free of a quorum of your school committee, but it's also a good thing to keep in mind when you're doing things like posting on Facebook. Is there a quorum of the body which is going to see this, going to involve in that? In general, this is a good one to fall back on whether or not you should actually be posting about your opinion about something that's under your purview on which you have not yet voted. Generally speaking, it's best not to do that anyway due to the code of ethics, but given the fact that you are a relatively small committee and running into a quorum is not that much of a challenge, it's a good idea again to avoid it because you could very easily end up violating the open meeting law. A couple of things that are exclusions in terms of communication. Distributing the meeting agenda, deciding on scheduling or procedural information is all fair game. Distributing reports or documents, provided that no opinion of the member of a public body is expressed, is also a fair thing to do. Generally, we recommend that be done through the superintendent's office or through the chair, so that there still isn't communication from an individual to the quorum of the meeting. A gathering is not a meeting if you are doing an on-site inspection of a project or program. So this is not uncommon of we're all gonna go look at the new school building project, or we're all gonna go see the next town over, which is running a cool science program that we're thinking of implementing. A private or public gathering, including, you know, we not uncommonly have quorums of school committees come to the statewide conference, or if you all went to a professional development thing, if everybody goes to the school, you know, play or basketball game, those are all fine. Attendance of you at a meeting of another public body that complied with the open meeting law, if for some reason you all needed to go to a select board meeting and they had posted, so long as all you are doing is participating as members of the public at that, that is fine. If there is any reason why you would actually be effectively meeting as your own body there, you want to make sure that it also gets posted. Also, it is assumed that and of course is good practice for school committee members to be attending a session of a town meeting, and that doesn't need to be posted. Although again, if for some reason you would need to potentially deliberate at the town meeting, you would want to make sure that it did get posted. So the top of this is what remote participation, is what remote participation used to be like prior to COVID. We obviously radically had to change this slide. I'm actually going to skip the bottom of this because we're actually still continuing under the COVID-19 protocols due to the extension that the legislature passed. You are allowed to continue to have 100% remote participation. The requirements are that you have to be audible to all persons present. All votes, as you've already been doing quite well, are taken by roll call, and the public must have real-time access to the meeting except for reasons of economic hardship. So there is actually a provision there for not that. Things that are always true, anytime the meeting is being recorded, the chair does have to inform all attendees of that. Public comment always requires permission of the chair, and it's always at discretion of the chair. That's actually written right into Mass General Law, Chapter 30A. It's not always something that people are necessarily aware of. There's no guarantee that public comment will happen, honestly, at any meeting. And the individual permission to speak is actually granted by the chair, partly just simply due to Robert's Rules of Order, but partly because the chair is actually recognized as being the officer in charge of the meeting for them to conduct orderly business of the district. As I think probably several of you know, making sure that you adhere to an even-handed provision of public comment following your public comment policy is actually very important. In terms of public participation, the public may attend the public open session of the meeting, may not address the public body without permission of the chair or otherwise disrupt a meeting. Audio and video recording are allowed. However, the chair does not need to be notified. And the subject to reasonable requirements is less of an issue now. It used to be one of those where people with giant cameras might try to stand in sight lines or that kind of thing. But nonetheless, subject to reasonable requirements. And the chair does need to inform other attendees that the meeting is being recorded. In terms of executive session, I'm not going to run you through the 10 reasons, but the thing that I'm going to make sure that you know is that there are 10 reasons. Executive session is, it allows for particular deliberations to take place out of the public eye. And you do have a requirement to maintain confidentiality. You cannot go into executive session for any reason that you like. There are 10 reasons that are delineated right again within Chapter 30A. And you do need to be making sure that you are only going into executive session for those reasons. It's not for anything that you like. In terms of remote participation, that is allowed. You each individually, if you're all remote, have to state that there is no one other person with you who is present or is able to hear the discussion. If for some reason you do need to have someone with you, we've been running into this, for example, with parents who might be at home with small children, a simple majority vote of the body can allow for another person to be present. So just keep that in mind because that has happened a couple of times. In order to go into executive session, you have to convene first in open session. You enter by roll call vote by a majority. All votes within executive session are by roll call and are put into the minutes. Before you enter executive session, the chair does have to state the purpose of executive session, including everything that may be revealed without compromising the executive session purpose. And this is important because the AG has actually cracked down pretty severely on public bodies in terms of things like, are you stating who the lawsuit is against, or are you stating who you're negotiating with? Those are all things that may be revealed without compromising the purpose of the executive session. So very frequently, those things are things that actually need to be included in your posting. And you do, before you go into executive session, have to announce if you'll be resuming public session at the end. I always think of this as the making sure the press isn't hanging around for nothing rule, but nonetheless, you want to make sure the public knows as well, particularly if they may be waiting for a vote coming out of executive session. That's really only fair. Executive sessions, as I noted before, are held in order to preserve the interests of the district. You as an individual member do not get to decide that you know better and violate executive session. The 10 reasons are all ones in which the interests of the district require that deliberation takes place out of the public eye. Thus, violating executive sessions by sharing deliberation or other information outside is actually an ethics violation because you are not upholding your responsibility as a member of effectively the legislative body that you are part of this. I mentioned this before, but as a member of the public body, you want to be cautious in your relationship with social media. Members certainly may communicate with members of the public through social media. However, be thoughtful about things like quorums. Be thoughtful about what you state about business that may be coming before you. Remember the code of ethics in terms of pre-committing to votes and so forth, and in general, proceed with caution. In terms of electronic messaging, use of the of electronic messaging with other members of the public body during a meeting, not at all a best practice. Communicating with a quorum obviously is a private deliberation and thus directly violates the open meeting law. But even less than a quorum is to be discouraged unless those deliberations are being shared with members of the public who are present. I will say that I think most of us who have had Zoom meetings probably have had a text or two that has said things like, you know, where's so-and-so, or I think we lost them when we switched, you know, applications. We all understand that the potential emergency kinds of communications happen, but in general, please make sure you're avoiding things that might be deliberation. And that is everything that I have for you. So I'm happy to take whatever questions you might have.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much, Tracy.
Of course. And I will, by the way, share this with you so that you all will have it for your reference.
Great. Okay, Eric, can you take us back to the regular format?
Actually, I can stop sharing my screen.
Okay. Okay, questions, Jennifer. Jennifer?
I have a question about, yes, I'm off mute, right?
Yes.
I have a question about the beginning of this meeting when Roger was motioning to add to the agenda. And I had watched Glenn Kuchar's parliamentary procedures workshop, and he includes that as a legal strategy that you can use. And in this case, something that was like the school closure happened within 48 hours of the posting, you know, of the meeting. Wouldn't that be appropriate to add it to the agenda?
There's only a need for it to be added to the agenda if there's emergency action that needs to be taken by the committee. And your school closure did not require any emergency action to be taken by the committee. So the emergency provision within the open meeting law is if, for example, you had a school burn down and the superintendent came to you because they needed a budgetary transfer or something of that nature. There have been provisions in which maybe particular policies needed to be suspended. But generally, it's most frequently it's things that are either budgetarily an emergency or legally an emergency. But the superintendent has the purview to do what the superintendent did. So that doesn't actually require an action of the committee.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Can I just ask a follow-up question related to that? And that is, so I think in Glenn's workshop, he had said it was a strategy you could use to get an item on the agenda that the chair is refusing to put on the agenda. And if the whole committee votes, you know, the majority of the committee votes to have that on the agenda, that would be a way to add it. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the way the agenda should be created.
Sure. So what Glenn's talking about is bringing something in under new business, which then would go on the next agenda. By a two-thirds vote of the committee, if the chair is refusing to put something on the agenda, a two-thirds vote of the committee can overrule the ruling of the chair. Does take a two-thirds vote of the committee to overrule a ruling of the chair. And it doesn't add something to the agenda of that evening. It would add it to the next agenda. Again, to make sure that you're not violating the open meeting law and that it actually follows the posting requirements.
So how do, for the current meeting, how is that agenda created? Could you just go over that
sure.
process?
So that's actually generally something that you want to have as part of your school committee protocols. The creation of the agenda falls under the purview of the chair, and the keeping of the agenda falls under the purview of the chair. Generally, it is created in close coordination with the superintendent, who, of course, is doing the day-to-day management of the school district and has an idea of what reports might be appropriate given the time of year, and also what decisions are needed from the committee regarding things like policy and budget in particular, given the time of year. If individual members wish to put things on the agenda, that's something that you as a committee need to have a protocol for. Generally, that involves a committee member emailing the chair and, you know, saying that they'd like something added to an agenda. For many committees, they have a calendar or some sort of a schedule, whether it's formal or informal, in terms of when particular issues are raised given the school calendar. And so it may be that in some cases, items aren't necessarily put on the next subsequent agenda after the email. They might better fall under something that's following later. And that would be something that's up to the chair to communicate to the individual member. But again, that process varies by committee. And that's something that you as a committee should have established so that you have a common understanding, again, along with the administration, as to what that process looks like.
Anyone else? Carl?
I have a number of questions. Tracy, for the executive sessions, I'm under the impression that it's required that you state the reason explicitly that you're entering the executive session. Is that correct?
I said that, yep.
Okay. All right. And that should be on the meeting agenda as well?
It should be part of the posting of the meeting agenda.
Okay, very good. Relative to what you just said to Jennifer about the agenda, I think I understand what you said, but it is true that the agenda is owned by the assembly as a whole, correct?
Only once you're actually rolling. I mean, really the meeting itself is under the guidance of the chair whom you have selected. So effectively then by selecting your chair, you then have selected the chair as the person who's actually organizing the business of the meeting, which includes the construction of the agenda. So this isn't it's only a democracy insofar as you've actually selected the person who's now heading the organization effectively.
Yeah, that seems to conflict with what I was told in the 8-hour training course, because they emphasize that the agenda is owned by the assembly as a whole, and the school committee can vote to delegate that responsibility to the chair, but you know, they underscored that the agenda is owned by the committee.
No, we don't actually say that. That's not something that we say. We do talk about the fact that the chair is the servant to the assembly, and that the assembly is actually the public body rather than the public meeting as a whole. But the creation of the agenda is under the purview of the chair. The individual members of the committee should have some way of contributing to that, certainly. And you should have a clear agreed upon process for that happening. But it isn't something that is, it's not potluck, shall we say, in terms of preparing the agenda.
Okay, can you speak a little bit more to the role and authority of the chair? I'm referring to the, you know, servant of the assembly, not the master and first among equals kind of stuff that's taught in the training course.
So the reason that we talk about the chair being the servant to the assembly is because ultimately it's up to the chair to make sure that the business of the assembly takes place. And that means ensuring that there's actually an orderly process of business, which means that among other things, only one person has the floor at a time, that people don't speak over each other, that the business of the meeting is actually conducted. That the minority as well as the majority, and by that I mean not only in terms of voting, but also in terms of who speaks the loudest or who speaks the longest, is recognized. Those are all actually the job of the chair, and ultimately ensuring that the school committee adheres to its role in staying with policy, goals, budget, eventually, as necessary, the evaluation of the superintendent without straying into the management of the district, which is under the purview of the superintendent. And not, by the way, only within the actual orderly procession of the meeting, but that's also the role of the chair outside the meeting. So ensuring that members of the committee, as uncomfortable as this position is, are not, for example, barging into the day-to-day business of the administration of the district. If there's someone who needs to be spoken to about that, that's actually the job of the chair to do that. Ensuring that, for example, members of the committee are not making unreasonable demands on individual members of the committee, on the individual members of the administration, that those requests are run through committee agendas, and are, again, if there are requests for information that are time consuming, that those are ones that are aligned with the vision of the district, with the goals of the district. Those are all part of the job of the chair as well. So effectively because that authority has been delegated by the committee to the chair then has those responsibilities outside as well as inside the meeting.
Okay, and last thing, could you speak to the requirement for training of school committee members?
Yes, as coming in, I believe in the 1980s, was a requirement that all school committee members receive 8 hours of training within their first 6 months. One of the things that we speak about in Massachusetts is that unlike some other states, there is not any consequence to that not happening. So the degree of adherence to that varies, I would say, across the state. I know that some of you are joining us, I think, this coming Saturday. I'm looking forward to seeing some of you in Pittsfield who are getting that in. So I know that I'm actually glad to be going back to in-person ones, because one of the things I've been missing, honestly, is getting to meet both new and long-term members. So one of the things, by the way, that we not uncommonly see long-serving members either in some cases having missed, because depending on the level of communication that you've received as an individual member, you might not have known. And also, it's one of the things that we sometimes will see members repeating over time. We've got some long-serving members who will come back every couple of years and just repeat it to make sure that they're refreshed on things like open meeting law. Obviously, school finance has changed the last couple of years. We've also added a section on superintendent evaluation in the last couple of years because we've had so many requests for it. So it can be a good thing to have even if you've already received the training before.
And Tracy, our regional district agreement specifies that a quorum consists of a majority plus at least one member from each town. Is that a common requirement across Massachusetts as opposed to just a simple majority?
The regional agreements very often have interesting kinds of sorting outs to make sure that the at least the voice of the various towns are at the meetings. So that's not uncommon, I would say, in regional agreements.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Yeah,
Deb, you had your hand up first.
Yep. Should a parent that has a concern contact the superintendent first before going to the school committee?
I would always say that a parent should start with a teacher. I would also, and as some of you know, I'm actually a school committee member myself in Worcester, would always take the parental call, but then in terms of the lines of authority, that's one where the school committee can really do a handy job in redirecting first back to the classroom, then to the principal. If there are circumstances in which you think that, you know, it needs to actually go to the nurse or the school nutrition director or whoever, you know, having that information can also be good. But I would never tell a parent not to call a school committee member. However, the school committee member receiving the call should then know where to direct the call. And usually that isn't going to be the superintendent.
I have a question. If
Arlene, I think that, let's see, wait a minute. Roger, you had your hand up next. So hold on a second, Arlene.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to ask you about the district goals and the formation of the district goals. That comes through maybe a subcommittee of the school committee, or does that come by working with the superintendent? What does that look like?
Sure. So the first question is whether you're going to have both district goals and superintendent goals. Some districts have both. Some districts also have, say, a strategic plan or something of that nature, which is kind of a long-term thing, which may then have district goals as part of it. Generally speaking, that's something that should be created honestly together. So it could be that you as a committee are hearing some common themes from your report to the superintendent in terms of, you know, we need to pursue particular kinds of facilities things, or we need to be focusing on a particular need in English learners or whatever it is. It may be that you then together create some language around that. Ultimately, it gets voted by the committee. And I will say, by the way, and this is somewhat related to what I've said previously, part of the reason it gets voted by the committee is because while the administration and the carrying out of that happens by the superintendent, it's up to all of you to ensure that the resources of the district get directed to it. So that's sort of a budgetary piece to it as well.
Okay, thank you.
Arlene?
Yeah, as a school committee member, because we are serving the community and the families, if a parent approaches you as a school committee member with a question, a complaint, whatever, how far do we go with that? And is that permissible? Or do we just say, sorry, go to the school and talk to the teachers or talk to the principal or the superintendent?
So good question. I think you always listen to anyone. I think when I said before that the school committee serves as a bridge between the community and the superintendent, you know, some of those conversations are that kind of conversation, right? Which you get stopped alongside the road or at the grocery store, or at the post office or wherever. And, you know, that's where those conversations take place. And sometimes those are very specific, and sometimes the specific though leads to the more general, right? Of this is a thing that's happening in third grade, but that really informs a larger conversation. And that I think is really where the judgment call of the school committee member comes in then, which is that if it's a particular question about third grade, you know, listening and being a sympathetic ear of the committee, and effectively then being a sympathetic ear of the district, I think is an important role of the school committee member, legitimately. You are very frequently, you know, the face and the ears of the school district to a lot of people. At the same time, though, then being able to say to this to the parent who has the concern, you know, that's something that you really need to take up with the teacher, with the special education person, with the, you know, whatever, particularly, again, redirecting to the school level. If you then feel that that informs something that's happening more at a district level, and I realize how big the district is, so those two things are the levels are not necessarily as separated as they might be in my own experience in Worcester. Nonetheless, you know as well as I do that what's something that's particular to third grade versus something that's particular to the entire school district is a different thing. Having that information inform your decision making is not in any way a bad thing. You just want to make sure that you're always not only using a single example in your decision making of, you know, have that inform what you're thinking about, but make sure that's not the only information you're bringing to your decision making.
Okay. Jess?
Tracy, you talked a little bit about Facebook and social media and posting things. As far as posting things, and can you talk a little bit about that being quoted somewhere? I mean, social media is big, but can you talk about websites and different things and posting your opinions, comments, things like that, please?
Sure. And I mean, by the way, one of the things I think is really important to acknowledge is that particularly, I mean, you were talking as I was coming on, right, about y'all are covered by the Eagle, and the Eagle's a great paper, like, you know, God bless them. But they also have a pretty substantial amount of distance to cover. And if they happen not to catch something that's going on in your town the night it happens, then where's anybody going to hear about it, right? You know, you've got a couple of other little options, but very oftentimes it's going to be something that people picked up on Facebook, right? So let's all acknowledge that. Like, this is the universe that we live in, and we can like it or not like it, but that is the universe that we're living in. I think that, again, in much the same way of Arlene's question of being an ear, you also can be a source of information. How you then choose to be a source of information, though, I think is really important. And that should mean things like providing links to the district website, providing links to the report, giving exactly the information that was given by administration. Those kinds of things are very much, I think, an important role of the school committee. Much in the way, I mean, we think of these things now only in terms of electronics, but it wasn't that long ago where, you know, any of you know that if something was happening in town, one of the phones that was going to ring was going to be the school committee members, because you were going to get half a dozen people who were going to call you to find out what the real story was, right? Because you were going to know because you were on the school committee. Facebook can be the equivalent of that, right? Here is the information as we have it, as much as we know. That can absolutely be part of your job as a school committee member. However, you want to make sure that you actually keep yourself to that. And it is absolutely always fair to say, I'm not going to talk further about this because it would be a violation, potential violation of the open meeting law. Not going to talk further about this because I don't want to speculate. This is all the information that we have at this time. And by the way, you also can shut off comments either to your page in general, or you can actually say, like, I'm not going to allow speculation on my page. I'm not going to allow this to become, you know, a place where people are going to be able to share false information. That's kosher. I think that those are all valuable positions for a school committee member to be taking. I think those are valuable. It's a way that you can be a valuable resource. I think that the ongoing thing, and I think perhaps I'm sensing some of this from you, Jess, is, you know, people start having a debate on something and they tag you in, right? So the first thing is, you, as much as it feels like you're being summoned, right, you don't actually have to respond to every single tag. The other thing is that that's another one where if it is possible for you to simply link to, here's what the superintendent said, here's what the report said, here's the information that we have, please consider coming to the meeting that we're having at X, Y, and Z time. Here's the budgetary number that we have. Anything that's very fact-based. I also often tell school committee members that one of the most powerful things you could do on Facebook is turn off further notifications of a chat. I do it myself all the time. So you've given your information. You don't need to continue to be dragged into the discussion, that you've done your part. You've given the facts that you have. And so I think that those are all valuable roles for the school committee member. Again, linking back to the facts, linking back to only the information that you have and so forth. And making sure that you're not pre-deliberating, committing to, you know, future action, any of those kinds of things. You can say, if someone says, well, are we going to talk about this? We're having a meeting coming up next Tuesday. You know, we're going to be, we're planning a meeting, which is coming up on the 30th. Please come talk to us, whatever it is. Those, that kind of invitation of, you know, I'm not going to have a conversation about this here. And also know that we're not having this conversation on Facebook, I think is also something. I had that comment come in on my own page this morning of, there's more people on Facebook, you guys should just have your meeting here. We have a posted public meeting. We have an open meeting law. We're going to adhere to 30A. If you want to be part of that, you need to make sure that you're actually involved in the public process rather than just posting on the town page. Don't assume that because it's here, it's something that's going to be part of anyone's deliberation. I think that sort of bringing that realm over can also be part of your job as a school committee member.
So essentially not posting as a school committee member, not making comments as a school committee member, or not
getting involved in the sort of disagreements and arguments as a school committee member, which I know can, and believe me, I do know this, it can be one of the hardest parts, right? Your disagreements and deliberations should happen in this realm rather than happen in that realm. I will say though that, you know, one thing that you will absolutely hear all of us at MASC say is that, you know, your First Amendment rights are not abrogated by virtue of you serving as a public official. So sometimes what we're telling you is what's wise rather than, you know, strictly saying, talking to you about your civil rights. Your civil rights are not abrogated by virtue of being a public official. You certainly, among other things, have the right to defend your vote. To explain your vote. Those are absolutely things that you can choose to do on Facebook. You do, of course, always need to remember that then the committee has voted the way the committee has voted. And I say that because very oftentimes you end up explaining votes that were unpopular rather than popular, that you as a school committee member do have the responsibility of then adhering to whatever the decision was made by the district. So you can use it that way as well. Just that can be one that tends to get more volatile, certainly.
Thank you.
Tracy, I have a question. Mm-hmm. In lieu of what we discussed earlier about community participation, if the school committee is meeting and there are a lot of parents who have a lot of questions about, you know, what's going on, they want to be on the school committee meeting, but they also want to have a voice. Mm-hmm. And according to what I understand, they can speak for 15 minutes or whatever we decide, mm-hmm. and there is no deliberation that is allowed at that meeting. How do we hear the public without breaking open, you know, without breaking any laws? And is it a right thing for them to come to the school committee with their concerns?
So the answer to everything you just said is yes. As much as that may sound sort of contradictory, I think that one of the things that's very valuable and that I'm seeing more and more committees do is to ensure that when you're going to have a public comment session, that you open the public comment session by reminding the public that there will not be responses from members of the committee, and remind them of why, that you are having a public meeting, that you are responsible as a deliberative body to inform the members of the public ahead of time as to what it is you're going to be discussing. And that, by the way, has to be pretty particular, not just we're gonna talk about COVID or whatever, like that's not good enough. And thus you're not going to respond to their public comments. You're not going to deliberate based on what they're saying. you certainly will hear them, that is part of why you're having public comment. You will take their information under advisement. It may well be that there is action taken later as a result of what they've testified about. The other thing I will say, Carol, is that sometimes if you're finding that there's a lot of questions from members of the public, and I may very well be telling you something that you already have been doing, there have been committees that have been instead holding public forums. And in some cases, what they're asking people to do is actually to send in their questions ahead of time. So that then, and here's an important part, it's generally the administration that's responding to the questions rather than the school committee itself. And that's one where it's more, say, process and procedure rather than people are wanting to have an argument over some part of things. So, you know, we're coming back to school. What's the classroom going to be like? What's lunch going to be like? What's transportation going to be like? What, you know, what's going to happen if somebody tests positive? Those kinds of things. That may be something where you instead want to have a public forum. If what has happened in the past, say, couple of weeks in your school district has raised concerns rather than questions, maybe that's something where you decide to have a listening session. And that's, though, again, going to be something where you need to say to the community, we are here, we will listen, we are happy to take whatever time it is that we're setting aside for this, but please understand that we are not going to take action this evening based on anything that you're saying. We may well take action in the future. What we're going to do is all listen to what you're saying. If there are particular actions that we end up feeling need to be referred to administration or that we need to take action on, then we will do so, but we will be doing so at future meetings. And I do think that's one where the chair in particular is the one who's leading the meeting, setting the expectation is good. But that's also one, to go back to Jess's point, where individual members of the committee, when they're saying we're having this session, setting the expectation for people can also be very important.
Okay, Jess?
I have a question.
I'm sorry, Jennifer.
I just have a question related to that. I'm wondering, as we go through the agenda items, and I suppose this is part of whatever protocols, you know, we can decide to adopt as a committee, but could we, you know, before we call for a vote on an item that's on the agenda, ask the community if they have any input for us before we make our vote? Is, because that's something I know my town's Board of Selectmen do, is ask for the community input before they make their vote.
What you might consider when you're deciding when you take public comment. So there are communities that take public comment at the end of the meeting. There are communities that take it more towards the beginning. There also are committees, and this is something, for example, my own committee does, is we limit public comment only to items that are on the agenda. So effectively what we know is that if you're coming to our committee meeting to speak on something, you're gonna talk about something that we're actually deliberating that evening. And thus your input is related to something that we potentially are going to make a decision on. You don't want to, again, this gets back to conducting the business of the committee, stop at every single session, every single vote, and ask for input, because at that point you actually have the deliberation of the public body happening, and you are the voices that are at the table. You can certainly take into consideration the voices of the public, but remember your BERC, that shouldn't be the only thing that you're using. You ultimately are sitting here for your own judgment, not simply to reflect the judgment of whoever happens to be speaking to you that evening.
Anyone else?
What, you said that committee, oh, sorry, I just had another question. You said that some committees hold the public participation at the end of the meeting. Is that something you recommend, like one way or the other, or it's really just up to the individual committee?
Yeah, I mean, and it's partly up to what you're trying to do with your public input too. If you're directing it more at the business of the actual committee meeting, then you naturally, to sort of your point, you want to be holding it at the beginning so that you've then heard that and can take whatever pieces of that you wish to into consideration in making your own decisions in the deliberation later in the meeting. If the idea is more to have sort of a come talk to us about anything that's under our purview kind of session, that happening at the end of the meeting can happen. I will say that depending on how long your meetings last, that may not be a particularly wise place to have it either. But that's really a local kind of protocol one.
Well, how do you, this is Arlene, how do you address when parents come on in a very upset manner? There's an issue, I don't know, COVID or whatever, it doesn't have to be COVID. And we're always saying to them, we can hear you, but we can't respond to you. You can go to the next agenda.
Right. What
mode can we use if perhaps it doesn't exist? That whereby we can deliberate with parents or hear them and then respond to them. It just seems so one-sided. It disturbs me.
Yes, yeah, so it is. And I think that that's sort of always a shared concern. Depending on what their concern is, that can be one where having the chair directing something to sort of specifically the administration. I mean, it's going to depend on the concern, but if it's something where this is something where having the school nurse call the next day is actually going to potentially lead to a resolution, saying that during the meeting of, you know, I've spoken to the superintendent's going to have such and such happen, that can at least resolve that issue. If it's something bigger, like I didn't like the decision that you all made about whatever, that's first of all not going to be resolved by the administration, but secondly, I think is something simply where, you know, as much empathy as the chair can channel, since the chair really should be speaking for the committee in that situation, is really the best thing that you have. And again, everyone preparing the ground ahead of time of, we're going to listen, we're absolutely here to hear from you, just realize that we're not going to take up what you're saying in deliberation that evening, because that would be inappropriate.
But then there's a month in between that meeting and the next meeting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I mean, again, you know, is that something where you need, I can't think of a lot of circumstances in which an individual parent is going to bring you something that's going to trigger your needing to post a meeting again right away. But I'm not going to say that there aren't circumstances where that hasn't happened. You know, there probably are. So that may be something where the chair says, well, we need to meet again at whatever, or we need, you know, or that the chair says to the superintendent, it sounds like that's pretty urgent. You know, I'm going to expect that you're going to take that up shortly.
Tracy, one more question for me. If you say that the school committee should not cross over into the area of the superintendent's authority, so if several parents come to school committee, let's just say, just for the sake of saying, they're not satisfied with the way the school is being cleaned under COVID regulations. Is that part of what the school committee should consider? Or should that school committee just say that's under the purview of the superintendent and that you must go through him first?
So that's a good question. And actually, it's one that's been coming up a lot these past 18 months, because we as committees all got so heavily involved in like the back to school plans and all of that sort of thing. So I'm actually having a lot of conversations with committees and superintendents that are sort of, you know, getting back into, well, where was that line? Because a lot of that line seems to have gotten blurry over the last 18 months. I will say that in general, and I don't know of any superintendent that would disagree, and maybe I'll run into one tonight, but nonetheless, that in general, if someone comes to you with a health and safety concern, like that to a very broad extent is kind of everybody's business. Not that you get into the particularities of it, but for you to refer that to the superintendent and say, you know, this is a concern we're hearing from parents. Could you bring something back to us that actually speaks to it? That's entirely appropriate, particularly if, and you know, I'm conscious here of how we're all spending our ESSER funding. It's something where you say to the superintendent, is this something where we need to, you know, hire another custodian, or you need a different equipment, or, you know, that kind of thing. That definitely falls under your purview. So that's a fair thing to do, of referring it to the administration and then saying, we'd like to hear something back from you once you have an answer for us.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you. Anyone else? I guess that's it. Oh, wait, we have one more. Carl?
I just want to go back to one thing that Jennifer said, Tracy, just to be clear, because I'm hearing from you that it sounds like, you know, public input should only be allowed at the beginning or the end of the meeting. And I just want to go back to what Jen said about how select board meetings are run in Sandusfield, because I feel they're particularly effective. There's an agenda published, there's agenda items. The select board will discuss the agenda, a given agenda item. When they complete their discussion, okay, they will then allow the public to comment on that issue to sort of let them know what people are thinking. And then they'll motion and vote. Are you saying that we couldn't choose to do it that way?
I am saying that I would not recommend doing it that way. I think that you're, I am certainly never going to critique the process of another public body. But yeah. In my position as your field director, I'm going to tell you that making sure that you're clear on the lines between your position as the public body that ultimately has the legal authority and decision making, and the role of the public, which is certainly to give input, but is not going to be the deciding factor, because you're going to take that into consideration along with whatever reports you receive from the superintendent, and using your own good judgment to make the decision. So I would recommend against having that be your process, would be the way that I would put that.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much for coming.